I almost had the lucky or unlucky experience of being stung by a wasp coming in here. I thought that'll wake me up. But I wasn't. So this is our first talk of our Ango practice period, our Ango Sesshin. And one of the things I wanted to say is that one of the things I love most about our practice is that it doesn't really give us anything. It doesn't. We don't create anything. We don't. There's no pressure. We don't have to make anything special happen. But our practice is designed. Every aspect of it is designed to help us realize what's already here. What's already the treasure. That is our lives. I was just about 10 minutes ago looking at one of the fruit trees and thinking, the fruit growing on the tree is not something special that happens in the life of the tree. The fruit is the life of the tree. The whole life of the tree is special, from the roots and the soil and the trunk and the bark and the branches and the leaves, the green grass that grows all around. And the fruit is part of it. You know, we could begin to see that there's a fruit, there's a treasure right here that's just part of our lives already, inborn. And we can appreciate that about our lives. And our practice is designed to do that, to help us do that. And lately, I'm probably wrong about this, but lately, I heard there's something new in the world of psychology called evidence-based psychology. And the phrase really took me... Have you heard the phrase, evidence-based psychology? The phrase took me by surprise, because I always thought psychology should be evidence-based. And I didn't realize it was new. And, I mean, obviously what I'm saying is that I don't understand the meaning of the term. But... you know, all of the different approaches to helping life, to helping human life, I think is kind of evidence-based. And Zen is way evidence-based. Zazen, our practice of Zazen is very evidence-based. We have 2,600 years of evidence and more of people discovering that if we sit down, we will discover what's here. There's 2,600 years of people sitting down and finding out that that's what it takes to discover what's right here. That's evidence-based. That's a long study. And what we discover is that the understanding that we seek, the equanimity that we hope for, the compassion that we hope will emerge, and the peaceful quality of being as we move through life, through a very difficult life sometimes, is already right here. And so the method works, in other words. And Zazen is not just a method to discover those things. Zazen is already an expression of those things. Just the fact that we're sitting Zazen is an expression of our understanding. It's an expression of our equanimity in our nature and of the quality of being that we seek. So just to sit down is pretty good. This Ango, the theme is inside the cocoon. And when I just said cocoon, I remembered I was teaching a poetry class at UCLA 30 years ago, and there was a man who liked to write haiku. And what I didn't know is that he was a very famous humorous haiku writer. And when I just said cocoon, I remembered his haiku. Pigeon on an electrical wire. Haiku. I was thinking, naked man on an electrical wire, very haiku. Well, anyway, that's probably, now that's part of the Dharma talk. Anyway, I want to talk about inside the cocoon. And, you know, we've all heard about cocoons, and we've heard about caterpillars and cocoons. And I looked it up to see, well, what does it say a cocoon is? And it said that cocoons are basically protective casings around an insect like a moth or a butterfly. They're often made of silk or some other fibrous material that's spun around an insect in the stage called the pupa stage, or the pupil. And typically the mind is so great, I thought it was pupil or pupil, right, like that. So I thought, oh, isn't that great that there's a pupil inside of this? So somebody learning something. And it turns out that that was correct. The pupa is an immature stage in the insect's life. And it takes the cocooning for the pupa, the immature stage, or the let's just say the not yet developed stage, to develop in the stillness and the quiet and the silence of that cocoon. In other words, that's the stage at which the pupa or the insect is undergoing transformation. And of course, we know it's kind of miraculous, isn't it, this transformation. It isn't like the butterfly that emerges from the cocoon is something special that happens to the insect. The butterfly is part of the life of the insect. And so the insect is transforming into what it already is. It's changing into what it is. It's not changing into something else. So we could learn a lot about our lives by paying attention to this one simple fact that the insect turns into the butterfly as a natural expression of its life, just like the fruit grows on the tree as a natural expression of its life. If we think about Zazen practice as something other than that, we have a misunderstanding of what the practice is based on. When I first went to the temple to practice, the very first time I was given a robe to put on, I felt like I had been cocooned. And I loved it. I wanted that cocoon so badly because I felt I needed to be wrapped in something. And of course, the robe was the beginning of being wrapped in a life of the Dharma. And I felt the kind of stillness and quiet emerge in me that I didn't even know was there. I thought I was going to have to go practice for 30 years and get hit on the head by sticks a lot, and you know, just be told I was wrong and stupid all the time, and eventually somehow that would benefit me. So this was not a clear understanding of our practice. As soon as I put on that robe, I could feel this stillness that was my nature. It emerged right away. And it was actually my aspiration that emerged. I could feel, oh, this is something I want. And I came here without realizing what I wanted, and it's already happening just by my coming here. So my aspiration, my unconscious aspiration, melded with an expression that was already inside of me. The expression was, I could already feel it. So again, it was already there. Usually, insects will form cocoons around themselves to protect themselves against harsh environments. And so as the light starts to fade and the days get cooler and shorter in autumn, insects will often cocoon in order to protect themselves against the harshness of the environment. And they kind of retreat. They go into a retreat at that point. And they have very ascetic practice. They don't eat food and they don't drink water. So it's very... Insects are tough ascetics. But one of the things that I learned in reading about it is that many people say that the uglier the cocoon, the more beautiful the butterfly. Which I took as a hopeful sign. For me, at least. It's amazing what you can learn on the internet. I think that most people who have some familiarity with the Zen tradition have heard of Bodhidharma, our Zen ancestor, who we chant his name every day. And he was the Indian monk who brought the practice of meditation from India to China. In India, in Sanskrit, it was called Dhyana, and in China, it was called Chan, and then Chan became Zen, the practice of Zen. And what's most famous about Bodhidharma is that he spent 9 years facing a wall inside of a cave. That was his practice. That's what we're told. So he went into a cave, wrapped in his robes probably, and faced the wall for 9 years. To me, it's a wonderful image of forming a cocoon. He cocooned in that cave. And he had no interest in being entertained or being distracted. He didn't check his email, they said. He didn't do video games or watch television shows. He was connected to this deep aspiration inside of himself. And his aspiration was to discover his true, authentic being. And so his idea was to sit quietly in the cave, face the wall. So nothing like, oh, look, what's that over there? Right? Just right up against the wall means right up against himself. And in the quiet and the stillness, he hoped that he would come face to face with who he really was. When I thought about the story of Bodhidharma, I thought he must have settled himself in there. And he must have felt excited, but he also must have felt scared. He must have felt some real thrill, like, okay, I'm going to do this, and also some real trepidation, like maybe he bit off a little more than he could chew. Some buyer's regret, maybe. Just like many of you feel here at Sushi. Excited and... like, why did I say I would do this? The first time I met one of my teachers, we had a wonderful conversation. I drove 450 miles in order to ask him if he would be my teacher, and he turned me down 3 times. And then I persisted, I pushed, and finally he accepted me as his student. And then I left, and I was walking down Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and I thought, boy, I never have to see him again. That's, thank goodness. I had instant buyer's regret having done all of that, so I know something about it. When I think of Bodhidharma cocooning, however, in that cave, knowing he was going to make the long haul, preparing where he would sit, where he would sleep, and where he would eat, and how he would eat. So physically taking care of his situation, I thought also about the cocooning of his heart and his mind, how he must have woven his intention and his aspiration and his deep yearning to know his true self around his heart and mind so that he would be embraced by his intention, embraced by his aspiration, and that would help him keep his commitment so that he could touch that place that I do believe we all have. Somewhere, even though we may not necessarily experience it, I think there's a deep belief that we actually can know who we are. In other words, we have a belief that our nature can know itself. And that's one of the reasons that we come to practice. We come because of this aspiration. And we come because the aspiration is supported by some kind of conviction, some kind of belief that this can actually be done. Otherwise, what is the point? Why would we do it? Why would we sit here with, you know, neck pain and back pain and leg pain and mind pain and heart pain? And in Buddhism, we have another model of it. The Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha, who, having tried I was going to say ascetic, but what started to come out was insect. All the insect practices of asceticism, of walking on nails or eating fire or whatever it is. All those stories that either are or aren't true. Finally decided to stop all of that and just simply sit down. The biggest challenge of all. Stop all the distraction of starving myself and beating myself and, you know, I don't know, hanging upside down by my ears. And just sit down and face my life. So I think that the Buddha and Bodhidharma had a lot in common. Again, they wrapped themselves in their intention. They wove their aspiration around their heart with the conviction that they might be able to do it. I think that's what happened. Our sasin is like Bodhidharma's cave. We come with excitement. We come with trepidation. We come with buyer's regret. And as we work with all of that, we discover that we're in a relationship. Sasin is really a relationship. It's a relationship to our deepest yearning. It's a relationship to our deepest self. And everything we do expresses that relationship. The way we bow, the way we sit, the way we walk, the way we bring our mind back to focusing on our breathing, not allowing ourselves to get entranced by the constant spell that a part of us would like to place us in. So it's a true relationship with the self, and it's a rare opportunity that you will say, I'm really going to give myself just these 3 days to myself. To the discovery of myself. And it takes a certain kind of cocooning in order to do that, as you all know. And like all relationships, there are many aspects. There's purity. Every relationship has a kind of purity, at least an intention. I mean, every nourishing relationship does. And every nourishing relationship also has struggle. And we move between these poles. And by doing that, we actually weave this cocoon. And we discover within that cocoon something about us. Sometimes inside of that cocoon, we can feel like we're at home, completely at home. Sasin is home. Everything is open, it's spacious, it's wide, there's room for us. No matter what comes, we can handle it. There's no walls, there's no ceiling, there's no door, there's no locks. Nothing. And sometimes sasin can feel like the tightest, smallest room, like a prison cell that we've placed ourselves in. It's the same person. It's the same sasin. So what makes it one and what makes it the other? I think it's worth us asking that question because it's the same question for our lives. It's the same person. It's the same life. It's another day. And today, it's great. And 1 minute later, it's hell. What has happened? How could that be? What creates this experience of love or fear, commitment or fleeing for our lives, running for the hills? And the other question is when we do find ourselves in that too tight room, in that prison cell, where the mind just does not seem to like us very much, where the heart just aches and aches and aches, where doubt just invades. How can we accomplish the second of our 4 vows, which is to transform delusion? Because by now you know that all of those things that are attacking us are sort of just kind of flying around delusions. We are not the worst person in the world. Everyone doesn't hate us. These are stories we tell ourselves, you know. The fact that we forgot to put a fork out at dinner doesn't mean we're terrible. And yet we suffer terribly because of these ideas that we have When I was thinking about Sesshin and Ango, I thought, one good answer is cocoon. How can we approach these different mind states, these different states of the heart, in a way that can really help us to transform from our habitual way of reacting into something that really allows our whole and quite beautiful nature to emerge. When we find ourselves in the grip of our greed, and we all have it, and our aggression, and we all have it, and our delusive thinking, we all have it. How can cocoon help us? When I think about cocoon, it isn't the shutting ourselves off from the world. That's something we should emulate. We cannot just go into a cave and face a wall for 9 years. We cannot just come to this beautiful place and sit here for the rest of our lives. We actually have to live our lives in the world. There, people depend on us to actually do things. There are things we want to do. So it isn't defending ourselves against harsh internal or external environments that I'm talking about. That's not the aspect of cocooning that I think is worth learning. It's good to come here and to cocoon physically in this way for a while to learn the more important part of cocooning. That's my view. The world is the world. It meets us with whatever it meets us with. It sometimes is quite beautiful, sometimes quite wonderful. It's always miraculous, but also, like it says at the end of a Lawrence Ferlinghetti poem from 50 years ago, but then in the middle comes the smiling mortician. He had good one-liners. There is old age, there is illness, there is death. There are terrible drivers that we have to share the road with. There are people at Thrifties with 25 items in the 5 or less line. Then there's the people who love us, like our parents and our spouses and our children and our friends and the people we love, and there's no end of problems there. I mean, if love is not a refuge. In other words, you know, and then there's us, just by ourselves, who either do or don't have our best interests at heart. There was a comedian I saw in Los Angeles, a woman spoofing the whole sort of hippie thing. Her name was Lotus Weinstock. And she told a story about being mugged. And she said, and in that moment, after years of meditation, I was able to see clearly that this man holding a gun to my head did not have my best interest at heart. She thought she was enlightened. She went and told her teacher. So it would be nice if we could lock all that stuff away, but that's not our way, and it's not possible. We live in the world, real human lives. So that's not the idea of cocooning, the idea of taking a defensive position against the harsh environment, external or internal. We can't shut it out. But think about that insect in the cocoon for a moment. What is its experience? It is still. It is quiet. It is not moving off its spot. During the time of its development from an immature to a mature, let's say, butterfly, it is still. It's not chasing anything. It's not running from anything. Its whole life is quiet. It's not coming. It's not going. It's not walking. It's not running. It's still in its being. It isn't just the physical activity I'm talking about. And in the stillness of its being, part of the stillness is the development of its maturation. In the stillness is the development. When we allow ourselves stillness, something different develops. Something that is us. Something that is not connected to what we do or don't want to happen. Something that happens naturally. And we can allow it to happen in the stillness. When we sit here during Sesshin, quiet, still, despite the physical stillness, many things happen, as you know. Many thoughts vie for our attention, many feelings come, many memories come. If we chase after them, we're actually moving away from our intention. If we try to engage those thoughts, they're like guests who come to your house. You know how it is, right? You get absolutely still, everything's quiet, and then suddenly somebody's knocking on the door. If we keep basically leaving our cushion, leaving our intention, and answering the door, the ability for what can grow in the quiet and the stillness of our being will be diminished, and maybe will be destroyed. I was thinking about, obviously about cocoons, and when I was thinking about wanting to tell you this, this part, I was thinking about how sometimes we take children to the zoo or to a nature exhibit, and they look at something behind the glass. Do you ever notice what kids do when they see big snakes behind the glass? What do? They tap on the glass. You can't get me. Let's see if we can get the big snake to move. That's what happens inside of us. There is a big, quiet being. And the little kids that we are keep tapping on the glass to see if we can get the snake to move. Almost never does the snake move. So we can learn from that big life too. When those guests come, those internal or external visitations, we can hang on to our stillness. Right in the middle of our life, we can cocoon. And cocoon, in the way I mean it, means to meet whatever comes, no matter what it is, with stillness. To meet whatever comes with quiet awareness, you know that it's there, but your awareness is quiet, and your attention to it is non-reactive. Non-reactive attention. Stillness. Quiet awareness and non-reactive attention. There's a kind of spaciousness that comes when we do that. A space that is big enough to absorb whatever comes. When we allow ourselves to stay still inside of ourselves, to be quietly aware, and to not have our usual habitual reactive response to it. When we allow this kind of spaciousness to occur, our sitting, our sesshin, and our life can go quite well. Because we've provided a huge amount of room for our life to take place. And the more we do it, the more that natural development of the beautiful butterfly that we are will come about. It really does require our stillness. Stillness in our heart. Quiet in our being. Non-reaction in our psyche. Out on the bulletin board, I put a poem. And the first part of the poem is a poem by Basho, the great Japanese haiku poet. And his poem is Lightning Strikes, But the sky is not disturbed. Lightning strikes, but the sky is not disturbed. The sky is not disturbed because lightning is part of the life of the sky. nothing terrible has happened to the sky. Simply, lightning struck because that's what happens in the sky. The sky did not run away from the lightning. The sky does not try to squelch the lightning. The sky does not try to defend itself against the lightning, because lightning and sky are just part of one life. If we think about that a little bit, we realize that there's a model that we can understand. Lightning will strike. Things will happen. But the heart and the mind that is aware to remain still inside of itself and quiet and non-reactive to those so-called negative states is a quality of being that can absorb life's rigor in a way that actually turns it into a kind of nourishment because of the spaciousness. When we meet our life with this kind of stillness, with the kind of spacious quiet that's so spacious that there's room for everything to happen. In other words, we're not in that prison cell. We're in a big space. We're living in a way that's quite good, I think. But it takes practice to do it. It takes remembering your aspiration to do it. It takes remembering that you have the intention to do it. This stillness and quiet I'm talking about does not come from outside. You cannot buy it. You cannot get it in the store. And you do not have to do something special other than sit down and allow it to emerge from your nature. It's already here. But it does take practice. There's no doubt about it. It gives a quality of being that is so helpful. Just think of all the times in your family when instead of not letting somebody, you know, take advantage of you by fighting them at the same level that they were fighting with you, if you had that presence of quiet awareness so that it's not like they were going to abuse you, you're aware of what's going on, but you didn't react in the usual way. You reacted with stillness of being. You reacted with quiet awareness. Things would go quite differently. I know it's very challenging. I have the same life you have. We all have the same life. But it can be done. And the way we practice it is here at Sesshin. When the mind tries to tap on the glass and make that snake move, the snake of silence can just hold still. Smile, oh yeah, the kids are tapping on the glass, but not more than that. Each person who's participating in Ango has chosen a different peaceful dwelling. As I said last night, Ango means peaceful dwelling. Some of you have chosen to work for the next 5 weeks with the peaceful dwelling of study. Some of you will work with the peaceful dwelling of service. Some of you will work with peaceful dwelling in relationships, in your family, in your home, or at work. Some of you will work with peaceful dwelling with one or more of the precepts. Some of you will just practice peaceful dwelling in your meditation with Buddha mind itself. So I want to encourage you to practice cocooning, to practice not being moved off of your intention, your aspiration, or your connection to that deep and spatial stillness, spacious stillness that's already inside of you. To remember it. And to help you remember to practice that commitment, I'm going to suggest that when you find yourself being moved off, you say, cocoon. Cocoon becomes your, what do they call it, like a touchstone word? There's a word for it.
Buzzword.
We talk about insects, so we make it a buzzword. Cocoon becomes your secret code that makes you happy. Every time you say cocoon, you become happy because you remember, oh, I'm going home now. You don't to fend against it. You work with it with stillness, with a quiet heart, until your reaction becomes a reflexive action. You just reflexively respond with this kind of quiet awareness that I'm talking about. And it will take practice for sure. But fortunately, life gives us a lot of opportunities to practice. This is the good thing. I've been working with this in my life. And sometimes, you know, as my family would tell you, sometimes I fail and sometimes I succeed. But I've been succeeding more simply because I want to. And so I have to really do it. I have to really try to allow the quiet awareness to be my response. Doesn't mean I'm backed off. I don't want to give the impression of distance. The quiet awareness I'm talking about actually brings you closer. It actually makes you more intimate, more loving, more present, more aware of the people that you're dealing with as they are. And the same with internal states. If I start to feel bad about myself, I've been practicing this cocooning. Okay, so there is room for me to feel that and everything else. It's a good practice. When this kind of cocooning becomes a reflective response, this is the Buddha sitting under the tree. This is Bodhidharma in his cave. And this is us in the midst of our life, cocooning. After I put together these notes for the talk, I remembered Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, had a perfect poem that shows his cocooning. And I looked it up and found it. It's a very short poem. This poem was written in 1965, after one of the Vietnamese villages was burned to the ground by American pilots. And the American military spokesperson said, "We decided we had to destroy the village in order to save it." That's, you know, that's kind of crazy. And Thich Nhat Hanh was so distraught about yet one more outrage against his people. And he wrote this poem called "For Warmth." "I hold my face between my hands. No, I am not crying. I hold my face between my hands to keep my loneliness warm. Two hands protecting. Two hands nourishing. Two hands to prevent my soul from leaving me in anger." That's cocooning. So hold your heart in your hands. Hold your mind in your hands. Hold your reactions in your hands to keep them warm. To keep you human, palpable, compassionate, flexible, and alive in a way that's useful to yourselves and to the world. Don't let us let ourselves fly out in anger. Keep the stillness. Keep the quiet. Practice it. And you will see that the peace that we long for and that we long to give to our world is already right here. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah, Candace.
Could you read the poem again, please?
Yeah. "For Warmth. I hold my face between my hands. No, I am not crying. I hold my face between my hands to keep my loneliness warm. Two hands protecting. Two hands nourishing. Two hands to prevent my soul from leaving me in anger." when Thay, Thich Nhat Hanh, first read this poem to us, we were together in a 10-day retreat in the mountains. He didn't, this has been changed. He didn't say, I hold my face between my hands. He said, I hold my face in my two hands. And that's different. So I don't know how Parallax Press published this. Maybe Thay gave them permission or something like that. But I remember all of us really had our breath taken away when he first said this. I hold my face in my two hands. No, I am not crying. I hold my face in my two hands to keep my loneliness warm. It's so active that way. Yeah. Two hands to prevent my soul from leaving me in anger. That's the deep practice of cocoon. It does not prevent the bombs from falling. It prevents new bombs from falling. The ones we might make. Anybody else have something they'd like to say? Anybody's butterfly wings? Yeah.
The two hands brought me off my seat a bit, and connecting with what you said about the cocoon, the way it gets made, mm-hmm. is by having two poles. Mm-hmm. So for myself, often if things aren't going well, I want to reject or turn away from the one way and go towards something I think is better. Mm-hmm. But what you've said today and this poem make me redouble my feeling that both poles, both ends, both extremes even, mm-hmm. are equally valuable to look at. Mm-hmm. Is that so?
Lightning strikes, but the sky is not disturbed. That's yes. Yeah, I mean, do you know how many times you'd have to turn to successfully turn away from all the terrible things that happen? You just goggle-eyed. I guess they say Google-eyed. That makes Google own one more thing. They already own enough. They have enough problems. Yeah, Chris.
Something that crossed my mind is about judgment and how quickly we judge. Mm-hmm. And I think, when we see someone with such compassion, like Thich Nhat Hanh, his country's being destroyed, and he's still not judging the killer. He's embracing that and holding it, mm-hmm. like holding his anger, holding the loneliness, holding whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the greatest gift, to somehow not judge. We're so quick to judge, you know. Oh, she's got a dirty mm-hmm. face, or, you know, whatever it is.
Do you know, he talked with us quite a bit about that. He has another poem called Call Me By My True Names. And in that poem he says, please call me by my true names. I am the child being thrown overboard, and I am the pirate. He is a firm believer in the basic root teaching of Zen Buddhism, which is non-separation. Not believing that there is some ultimate this and that, me and you, bad guy and good guy. He understands the interdependent nature of the causes and conditions of all things, and he lived it. When Thay was in Vietnam, before he was exiled and refused admission, when he was in Vietnam, he was attacked by the North Vietnamese and by the CIA and the South Vietnamese and the U.S. government, because he refused to take a position other than, I will help whoever is hurt by this war. So when pro-communist village people were hurt and they needed food or rice or something, he and his young people would go and bring them rice. And when pro-South were hurt, he would go and with his young people and rebuild their hut and bring them food. Consequently, everyone, both sides hated him, and they wanted him dead. And he told us once that he was sitting inside of a hut, and a grenade was thrown right at the hut. And just at that moment, a wind blew the flap of the hut and it knocked the grenade away, and so he wasn't killed. And I asked him, what was that wind? And you know what he said? Love. It was such a startling answer. But you know, he's just a guy. Mm-hmm. He's 84 years old this year. And he's like we are, if we want to be. He began his practice at 16. And 1942 is when he started practicing. So, it's amazing, I remember all these things, but I don't know where my car keys are. Anyway, the point is that Thay's practice and our practice and the Buddha's practice and Bodhidharma's practice is just the same practice. It's evidence-based. Cocoon. Don't get moved off your spot. Yeah, Roland.
Yeah, Peter, I think you were talking about responding with equanimity and spaciousness, not moving in one direction or another. So I'm thinking that that's kind of an expression of compassion. Mm-hmm. I often think of compassion as a kind of specific feeling, but it seems to me perhaps that just spaciousness itself is a way that compassion acts. Mm-hmm.
Because spaciousness is non-dual.
Yeah.
Right. Spaciousness is non-dual. If it's non-dual, then it's all-inclusive, as Dogen would say, all-inclusive. All-inclusive life, all-inclusive practice, all-inclusive awareness, all-inclusive understanding. It means no matter how much we hate somebody, we don't get to throw them out of the room. We have to deal with this because it's only human ignorance. And we are on that continuum too. We are on the continuum of human ignorance, as we all know. All the things we wish we hadn't done. All the times I wish I had shut my mouth. That's part of the continuum of the worst thing. And that's why Thay could say, I am the pirate too. Because he knows who he is. But to know it and not hate yourself requires the spaciousness that I've been talking about. The non-reactive. See it, know it, understand it. This is not a life of quietude. This is a life of action. Much is needed in our world from the standpoint of our stillness. You know, in our chant at lunchtime, we chant Great Manjushri Bodhisattva, great wisdom. Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, great activity. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, great compassion. Great wisdom, great activity, great compassion. None of them can take place unless there is that still, quiet awareness, that spacious being at the root. Otherwise, we're still in it for ourselves in a smaller way. So it's kind of worth spending some time with it.